from deep inside your radio.
Everybody loves Mozart. It's true. The emails prove it. Speaking of emails, ladies and gentlemen, I have a Christmas gift for you. Oh, you lay low when somebody on the air says that. Because that means send me money. No, it doesn't mean send me money. It means, you know, that it pains me to use valuable broadcast time to promote my own stuff here on the air. But still, promotion must be done. So, if you'd like to get one weekly email advisory, see, I'm the last to climb aboard this particular hack wagon, a weekly email advisory from this broadcast, stuff about of interest to listeners of this program, i.e. stuff about me. We will only send it to you if you ask for it. Request being put on the list for the Le Blast, I guess would be the way to call it. Anyway, at lemail@interworld.net. And I promise no more than one a week, ever. And we will not give, sell, lend the list to anybody else for any reason. Okay? And you can trust me. Look, here I am on the radio. That's my Christmas gift to you. Because I'm... Hello, welcome to the show.
La, 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 la. Oh, deck the halls with boughs of holly. La, 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 la. Tis the season to be jolly. La, 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 la. Come we now our gay apparel. La, 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 la. Know the ancient Yuletide carol. La, 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 la. See the blazing Yule before us. La, 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 la. Strike the harp and join the chorus. La, 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 la. Follow me in merry measure, fa la 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 la, while I tell a Yuletide treasure, fa la 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 la.
Welcome to the show. I'm Harry Shearer from the Edge of America, from the home of the homeless, and we start off this special pre-Christmas edition with our exclusive, and I say exclusive only to emphasize the value of this service to you, the listener, same way AOL does. Our exclusive feature, Tales of Airport Security. No, it's not just the music. Don't panic. Dear Harry, I flew from LAX to Albuquerque on Thanksgiving Day. I checked in baggage quickly, but in order to proceed to the gate, was directed to the security check line. The end was out the door of the terminal and down the sidewalk past the next terminal. For an hour and 20 minutes, I was standing in the exhaust and hot sun, wearing winter clothes from my 20-degree destination. A group of Hispanics marched back and forth with misspelled banners and signs protesting the INS crackdown on illegal immigrants. I can't think of a less receptive audience as I stood there sweating, doing my part for the country's security. Upon my return to in Albuquerque, going through the scanners was interesting. I took off my hat, coat, boots, and purse, but I set off the alarm. They were quite polite in ushering me to a correct sex agent to pat me down. I took off my earrings, my boots, my belt, my socks, which were all sent to be scanned. But the problem seemed to be my ankles. With my pant legs pulled up and my feet naked, my ankles still set off the alarm. The poor agent was baffled, but thankfully, let me go on my way. Dear Harry, on a recent trip from Los Angeles to London on an airline whose two identical initials I won't mention, I was stopped by the L.A.-based security folk and asked to remove my thick-soled Wellington boots. The footwear was deemed safe, and I made the lengthy flight, smarting from the slight inconvenience, but comforted. My visit to England at an end, I took the Heathrow Express from Paddington Station. Sadly, I discovered the aforementioned airline had closed its check-in counter at the train station after 9/11. My timing now shot to heck. I arrived at the terminal with my unchecked baggage a mere 40 minutes before the scheduled departure. Desperate not to miss my plane, I threw dignity to the winds and asked the maroon-coated security agent at the head of the overcrowded check-in line if I could get special consideration. He informed me that I was too late. I asked if he could call someone, anyone, to see if there was still a seat available. He slowly raised the walkie-talkie to his lips and learned that there was room and cautioned that a late arrival was on the way. He then led me to a vacant check-in desk where I was asked the mandatory questions, including if I had any lighters or matches in my luggage. I replied that I thought I had some matches in my shaving kit. "Could you please take them out?" demanded the clerk. Unwilling to open my overstuffed Pullman and risk missing the flight, I told him that maybe I didn't have any matches. He nodded and checked in my suitcase. I then made the lengthy trek to the security gate where the ever-vigilant watchers passed me right through, clad as I was in the same Wellington boots that attracted attention in Los Angeles. "Hello, Harry. I love your tales, and I'm happy to report one. Since 9/11, my husband and I have flown four times. My husband has been told he looks like Jesus. He has shoulder-length blonde hair, blue eyes, beard, and mustache, and is on the thin side. He has been flagged by security three out of four times and singled out to be personally checked. The last time he was flagged, the security officer waved the wand all over his body, and it beeped at his stomach area. He wasn't wearing a belt or anything. My husband lifted up his shirt to show the officer it was just skin. They waved him through without further hassle. Meanwhile, an 11-year-old boy was also flagged. There is a rule, apparently, that children under 12 cannot be searched. He trudged onto the plane unfettered, bragging that he was carrying a bomb. And finally, Harry, here is my tale of airport security. In December 2001, I went to the Philadelphia airport to pick up my mother-in-law. Already by that time, non-ticket holders were not allowed to be at the gates beyond the metal detectors. Her plane was late, so I spent an extra 45 minutes waiting right outside the security checkpoint. Here's where my story gets interesting. I happened to notice a large cardboard box about 4 feet high sitting unattended. Knowing the familiar warning about how all unattended baggage will be removed, I thought to myself, I must be mistaken, there must be some attending passenger for this box. It was really a blatantly large box. For over half an hour, I saw passengers come and go, and no one ever came for the box, nor loitering near it. I approached the airport security and reported the big box, pointing to it. Their response after a pause was, "What's inside it?" I had to admit that I had not taken it upon myself to inspect suspicious luggage, and I did not know what was inside it, that I was merely on alert, so to speak, and thought I should bring it to their attention. They seemed nonplussed. When I left the airport, the box was still there. Tales of airport security, often imitated, seldom imitated. Ladies and gentlemen, from the British press, a couple of items that you may not have heard. On the American media, I don't know. The United States edited out, how many pages did the United States edit out of Iraq's 11,800 page dossier on weapons? The one we said was full of omissions? You know that the non-permanent members of the United Nations Security Council received an edited version of that dossier, edited by the United States? How many pages were edited out? According to today's Guardian in London, 8,000 pages. 8,000 pages were edited out before the sanitized version was passed on to the 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council. The full extent of Washington's complete control over who sees what in the crucial Iraqi dossier might call into question the allegations made by U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell that omissions in the document constituted a material breach. Last week, Secretary General Kofi Annan accepted that it was unfortunate, his word, that his organization had allowed the United States to take the only complete version of the dossier and edit it. He admitted the, quote, approach and style were wrong, unquote. Norway, a member of the Security Council, says it is being treated like a second-class country. I think that's a promotion for Norway. No, it's not a knock on Norway, but second-class country's not bad these days. The non-permanent members of the Security Council have no way of testing the U.S. claims of recycled information and flagrant omissions for themselves. A UN source in New York said, what did the U.S. take out? And if weapons inspectors are supposed to be checking against the dossier's content, how can any future claim be verified? Current and former UN diplomats are said to be livid at what some have called the theft of the Iraqi document by the United States. Hans von Spanach, the former assistant general secretary of the UN, said, this is an outrageous attempt by the U.S. to mislead, unquote. And, from the same newspaper, maybe they have an axe to grind, maybe they don't. United States President Dick Cheney Friday night blocked a global deal to provide cheap prescription drugs to poor countries, following intense lobbying of the White House by America's pharmaceutical companies. Faced with furious opposition from all the other 140 members of the World Trade Organization, the U.S. refused to relax global patent laws, which keep the price of drugs beyond the reach of most developing countries. Talks at the WTO's Geneva headquarters collapsed after the White House ruled out a deal which would have permitted a full range of life-saving drugs to be imported into Africa, Asia, and Latin America at cut price costs. The negotiating strategy, according to sources in Geneva, had come straight from the White House, with Mr. Cheney seizing the reins from America's trade negotiator Robert Zoellick. Zoellick helped broker a deal on affordable drugs at the WTO's meeting last year in Doha, under which developing countries were promised they would be able to override patent laws in the interest of public health. Trade envoys said the negotiations are likely to resume next month, but Friday night's failure could push the entire Doha agreement to the brink of collapse. And maybe it couldn't. We'll see. Anyway, Dick Cheney, underground, but on the alert. Who would you say is the face of Christmas, ladies and gentlemen? I'm going to nominate Linda Tripp. That's me. That's just me, you see. Nominating Linda Tripp. No, it's not arbitrary. In Middleburg, Virginia, a tiny town that is home to French antique shops, saddleries, and historic militaria, the newest business on Washington Street is the Christmas Sleigh, a year-round holiday store run by, among others, Linda Tripp. Local officials, business owners, and Tripp's 27-year-old son, Ryan, say the move is part of her gradual reemergence into public life. They never want privacy, do they? 4 years after, you know what she did 4 years ago. Tripp has chosen for her return to the world of work a town that has mastered the art of whispered commentary about its celebrity residents, beloved or controversial. It's pretty discreet. That's why Jackie Onassis moved here, because they left her alone, says D.D. Hubbard, a president of the Middleburg Business Association. We've had bigger and more important celebrities. I've got Liz Taylor, Robert Duvall, Paul Mellon, John Ken Cook, Linda Tripp. People here aren't starstruck. Vice Mayor Mark Tate, who owns the Coach Stop restaurant next to the Christmas Sleigh, said celebrities, famous or merely notorious, usually just blend into the fabric. Tripp does not own the store, according to her lawyer. He also declined to say whether she is helping to finance it. But Tripp has been directing the design of the store, since work began about a month ago. It formerly housed the Middleburg Hardware Store. So let Linda Tripp solve your Christmas gift problems, ladies and gentlemen. Won't you? Won't you do that? Now, the week ended with Trent Lott leaving the Senate. This is the kind of luck Al Gore has had. He couldn't even have a full news cycle for him pulling out of the race for the presidential nomination because the Trent Lott story eclipsed him. But still, it was a week that began with Al Gore pulling out of the race and ended with Trent Lott pulling out of the Senate leadership. What kind of holiday are those guys having?
Christmas for Trent is a lot more like Lent. He gave up far more than he got. For days and for weeks, Santa only brought leaks, dissolving the pillar of Lot. Dissolving the pillar of Lot. So now he's down south with a sock in his mouth and a holiday decked out so grim. It's as odd as can be when you look at his tree. All that's hanging from it is him. All that's hanging from it is him. And it's Christmas in oblivion. The family is gone away. There's a brightly lit pin for each bite of bin. The reindeer are pulling a half-empty sleigh. The toddies are just straight whiskey with a couple of plastic cubes. It's Christmas in oblivion. The holiday's down the tubes. Days down the tubes. Al's special gift, his poles got a lift the minute he self-released. Bad algorithm, the crowd wasn't with him. He did best by doing least. He did best by doing least. So his season is bright, his mood is so light, and Santa is flush with relief. There was only one thing the old guy couldn't bring, the dollars that spelled out belief. Oh, the dollars that spelled out belief. And it's Christmas in oblivion. It didn't even snow. There's turkey and skate and a vegetarian plate. And the wonderful news that there's nowhere to go. Did a tree this year, it's still growing in the ground. It's Christmas in oblivion, and it's certainly going round. It's certainly
Christmas in Oblivion singers, ladies and gentlemen, with Christmas in Oblivion. And now, another copyrighted feature. Jeez, will they ever stop? It's time for me to read the trades for you, ladies and gentlemen. Updating you on the digital television wonderland, because there's still time to get that digital TV for everybody on your Christmas gift list. Don't you think? First, from... Good Lord. I know it's from a trade magazine. I can't tell you which one. How about that for sourcing? CBS will pull the plug on HD without a broadcast flag. I'll read it for you. It is from a technical trade magazine, but the name fell off. CBS is playing hardball on the copy protection issue, threatening to withhold its vaunted high-definition television programming next fall if the FCC doesn't come up with effective rules to prevent digital piracy. Viacom, in its statement to the FCC, says, Viacom believes that digital television sales have reached the tipping point at which it can no longer afford to expose its content to piracy. A broadcast flag regime is needed now to protect the value of our important assets, or we must hold our quality, high-definition digital content. If CBS or other networks followed through with the threat, it could be a blow to digital TV manufacturers and boosters who've recently been able to point to more high-definition programming. CBS programs 24 hours of it weekly. A spokesman for the Consumer Electronics Association, which has advocated less restrictive protection schemes than the networks, was not immediately available for comment. Meanwhile, from Current, the trade magazine of public broadcasting, Americans aren't buying high-definition television, and PBS is reluctant to spend the money to produce it. For every 10,000 high-definition receivers purchased, the network proposes to produce one additional hour of high-def programming. PBS now broadcasts 48 and a half hours of high-def programming a year. Nearly a half are from the Latino drama American Family. By fall 2003, PBS expects Americans will own 600,000 high-definition receivers. Under PBS's formula, the network would distribute 60 hours of such programming next year, says Darren Triff, vice president of Digital Ventures. Consumer confusion threatens the sales of high-definition sets. With HD's failure to take hold, PBS has reduced its high-def programming over the past 3 years, according to Triff. Fox presents a few hours in widescreen standard definition, but none in HD. What is it? Cost too much? PBS faces a practical disincentive. While the big networks actually save money by switching from film to high-definition tape production, public TV producers face higher costs of conversion because they typically shoot standard videotape rather than film. PBS planners believe it will cost an additional $30,000 to $50,000 an hour to move its primetime programming to high-def digital. Producing just 10 more hours in 2003, as PBS expects to do, could cost the network about $400,000. PBS management proposed unsuccessfully to boost programming fees, but the PBS board, with advice from stations which would have to pay the fees, rejected the increase. One other option may be going to digital TV makers such as Panasonic, Sony, and Zenith, who underwrite the high-def costs of commercial network broadcasts like The Tonight Show. PBS is retooling its underwriting practices to accommodate category underwriting for programs of a certain video standard, don't you know? Further news on this subject from still another publication. The Digital Video Broadcast Group has yet to reach agreement on the definition of an authorized domain for you once you've legally obtained content to view it, copy it, and distribute it for your personal use. whether a limit should be imposed on the number of devices you can use within your authorized domain, and what types of equipment should qualify for inclusion in your authorized domain. Insiders say Hollywood studios are demanding that the Copy Protection Group consider a way to add geographic limitations to where content, once legally obtained by a consumer, can be viewed. The plan is similar to the unpopular regional coding scheme used for DVDs. It's a wonderland. Get some for everybody on your list, won't you? Ladies and gentlemen, that's the conclusion I draw when I read the trades for you. Coming up, a special segment of the broadcast. We go to New Orleans to visit Rio. Next, upcoming on Le Show.
Don't you lock the door.
Rarely is someone allowed to be a guest in the Le Show Dome, and even more rarely is someone allowed to guest again. This is a privilege. Well, it's not a privilege. It's just it's a way of wasting somebody else's time instead of mine. And I'm welcoming back for a second appearance here from New Orleans, Louisiana, a friend and an amazing pianist, composer, Tom McDermott. Tom, welcome first.
Thanks for having me, Harry.
This is just proving that you exist. Secondly, the last time you were here, we've been doing a series of programs with the great piano players of New Orleans, of which there are many, of which you are one of the exemplars. But you've gotten a new musical love in your life, and you've been sharing that with me and a bunch of other people on your email list. You're the only person I allow to send bulk email to that I read. Here's what we did last week. But Tom has been sending musical diaries of of Rio de Janeiro and Bahia and other parts of Brazil. And you've really become fascinated with Brazil. Tell me how that started to happen. How somebody who came here excited by this music has now had that experience again.
Well, I moved here in 84, and I had a piano gig at a place called the Gazebo, and around, I don't know, 85, 86, a fellow came up to me. I was playing some ragtime, and he said, "You know, that music sounds like a fellow named Ernesto Nazaré. You ought to check him out." And the first time I was able to find Nazaré LP, oddly enough, at Harrods in London, I bought it and really took to it immediately, and that opened up whole world, this whole choro world to me, and I've been exploring it ever since.
See, this is the difference between at least piano players and comedians. We don't listen to our hecklers.
Well, this is a good heckler.
Oh, okay.
An instructive heckler.
An educated drunk, was this?
It was too early in the day for him to be drunk.
No.
Yeah, this is in the afternoon.
And when you say Nazaré, people might not get an image of how that's... it's spelled like Nazareth,
that's right.
Like the band Nazareth, but musically very different.
Let's just say different, yes.
Okay, and when did he live?
His dates were, I think, 1863 to 1934, something around then, 60s to 30s.
Okay, and what, you know, he as your entrance into Brazilian music, what struck you about him?
Well, how similar he was to Scott Joplin. I have been a ragtime fan, composer, player since my youth in St. Louis, which is the cradle of that music. And Nazaré was writing music that predates Joplin, but is very similar in form and in stylistic influences. Basically, Brazil had the same mix at that time and to this day of Africans and Europeans, although the countries they took their Europeans from are a little different than here, but that created a similar fusion with different rhythms, basically.
Africans and Europeans in happy harmony, just like here.
Yes.
You say choro. I've been a listener to a radio program of Brazilian music, not the one from here, but from Los Angeles, and the host of it always says, "Choro, a kind of music from Brazil." And that's the entire explanation that he gives. He's been doing it for years. Can you go about two sentences deeper than that?
Yeah, it's the main instrumental music of Brazil. If you think of samba and bossa nova, it's vocal music. Mm. But choro is the accompanying instrumental music that predates samba and, of course, bossa nova, beginning around the 1870s and still influencing the composers today. Jobim wrote some, Hermeto Pascoal has written some, Ginga, etc. Started out, as I said, very similar to ragtime with, you know, two or three themes, typically three themes, a certain form, A, A, B, B, A, C, C, you know.
Not to be confused with ABBA. I'm just...
You keep wanting to bring these rockers.
Well,
in
you know, that's my world.
Yeah. So, does that help?
Yeah, but what would really help is to hear one.
Okay. Well, let me play one of mine.
Excellent choice.
and I had the pleasure of playing this at the Jambalaya Jazz Festival, which was started this year by a New Orleanian named Tom Andre as a festival to link up New Orleans and Brazilian musicians. He brought a number of New Orleans players down there. Anyway, I had the chance to play this with Paulo Moura and other eminent Choro players, so it was a big thrill for me. They all made a point of coming up and telling me, this is a good one. So,
And it's called?
Tentatively called Choro Number 3 until I come up with a better name.
Number 3.
That's it.
Are Choros number 1 and 2 existful?
Yes, they have both been recordable.
Okay. Now, as you're playing a piece like that, do you are you keeping score? Oh, crap, I missed that. Oh, I didn't quite do that the way I wanted to. Or are you in some other kind of zone? Where are you in the middle of those?
I'm afraid I am in the zone you just described.
And so how do you keep yourself from a perfectionist mentality could tend to get so veered off into the, I should have, that you then lose track of where you are now and into the near future?
Yes, but perfectionists tend to practice obsessively, which is something I don't, I know.
That thing. But do you get a feeling like in the middle of that as you're going into the B section, I've got so far to go, I've got so many things that I know I've got to try to get right this time?
Not quite that. I just rue the mistake after it happens.
Yeah, okay.
Especially if it's something that's being recorded and put out there.
Oh, nobody hears this show. Take it from me.
Yeah, live performance, that's something else, as you know.
Then there's old Mr. Adrenaline kicks in.
Yeah, I think so.
Most people, I would say, are familiar with Brazilian music from probably being exposed to bossa nova. New Orleans music, as you play it, as we listen to it, is a minority music in a music culture dominated by other cities. What's it like in Brazil? You've explored it enough. The music you love in Brazil, how does it fit into the music that people are listening to on the street or the music that people are dancing to?
Well, there's still, samba is, I think, clearly still the national music down there.
That's just the music like that they'd play at Carnival? And
yes, and every other time of year. The first samba, amazingly enough, was recorded the same year the first jazz piece was, which is 1917.
Really?
Yeah, which I find a nice coincidence. And whereas in America, jazz died out because it stopped being dance music, I think. That's one theory. You know, samba is still roaring down there as dance music.
Don't tell Ken Burns that jazz died out. Gee. When you were down in Rio or in Bahia, what gets played on the radio? You don't hear this music, right?
You don't hear choro. You hear samba. You hear more modern Emepebe, you know, Caetano Veloso and Chico Buarque. And it's such a vast musical culture, I feel like I shouldn't generalize. Mm. It is literally like if somebody had grown up in, you know, Vladivostok and then heard their first bit of American music when they were 30. I mean, it's almost that vast. There's so much of it, and I just don't feel right talking about it too much. But you know, I'm happy to play what I love. And
you're playing the role of the humble blind man who can only describe his piece of the elephant, which is fine.
But the piece gets bigger every time.
That would be the goal. You have this party trick, which you do, which involves a Scott Joplin tune done as ragtime purists would have it, and then done in choro style, or
yeah, well, at least with the left hand, the Nazare, who is choro pre-choro. He's on sort of like the early edges of what choro music is,
and proto choro,
ur choro. Yes.
Okay. Why don't you regale us with that?
Okay. This is Joplin, the first strain of Joplin's Chrysanthemum, first played with Joplin's left hand and then Brazilianized.
Joplin hear the early Brazilians? Did the early Brazilians hear Joplin?
That's a good question. I know that there was the tradition in Brazil of playing piano music with silent movies, and that silent movie music got down to Brazil in the 20s. Interestingly, Nazare and the early choro players predate the early ragtimers. They started in the 1870s, and the first published rag was not until 1895 or 6, I believe. Joplin's started in 1899. So that's, you know, early jazz history is a little murky. There was a Gottschalk connection. Now, Gottschalk was from New Orleans and writing syncopated music up until his death in the 1860s, died in Rio, and his music was popular down there, so there's some link that way.
Hmm.
But no, I don't know if the Maple Leaf Rag was heard in Rio de Janeiro, or if Nazare's early music, when it was first heard in America. I can't answer that.
If you've been to Rio a bunch, when you go there, you seem to be partaking of a veritable feast of music. Is that something that's open to, I mean, if the listener to the program went down to Rio, is it just unbelievable?
Well, it is, but you would have to go outside the main tourist areas, which are...
Oh, no.
I know, it's a big punishment for
Where am I going to buy my T-shirts?
You can, you know, stock up on those while you're in Bourbon Street,
okay.
You know, and then when you go to Brazil, you get other priorities. No, the main tourist districts are Ipanema and Copacabana, especially Copacabana. but
well, you see the girls with the gazangas, right?
You said it, not me. But the, I mean, you can hear good music there, of course, but the music I'm talking about, Choro and the samba clubs, is in a district called Lapa, which is downtown. I mean, perfectly easy to get to as well, but there's a real explosion. And what is great for me is that this music, which has its 19th century music, it's still, I mean, there's young people, 20-year-olds, dozens of 20-year-olds and young people taking up the torch and playing this music. It would be like if in New Orleans you had, you know, 500 kids playing really good traditional jazz, which is, I'm sorry to say, is just not the case.
Is the torch a traditional Brazilian musical instrument?
Oh, torso.
Play another one, if you would be so kind.
Would you like a Nazaré?
Yes.
Okay. This is his most famous piece. It's called Odeon, named after the theater where he played piano.
In the day, was that popular music? Was that considered classical music? Would people buy sheet music and try to learn how to play that?
Nazaré was popular in his day. Whether he was popular outside of Rio, I don't know. But Nazaré is considered, like Joplin, sort of a transition figure from, you know, whereas Joplin could be called classical music or it could be called pre-jazz. It's the same with Nazaré. And I should also add, the Choro music, as we know it, exists like ragtime as solo piano music. But when you go down to Rio and hear it, it's a band music. It's an ensemble music with, you know, the cavaquinho, which is their ukulele, and the mandolin, and guitars, and flutes, and pandero as the percussion. So we're talking an ensemble music, just as ragtime back in the day was a band music. Today you hear it almost entirely as solo piano music. And, I mean, that's how I play it because I'm a pianist. But really, choro music, 99% of the performances you would hear in Brazil would be band performances.
Possibly because it exists in the hermetically sealed universe of Portuguese language culture. Brazil seems to do perfectly well on its own, but how overwhelmed do you feel when you're down there by the influx of American music, if at all?
It's certainly down there, but I don't let it intrude into my universe. You know, and I certainly have no, you know, that's just the way culture is. You know, they're going to take from whatever, and there's reggae and rap infiltrations, and that, to me, that's fine, just as long as the old stuff is kept alive as well, which it is.
Yeah. So the two coexist and kind of feed each other. I mean, I remember hearing Veloso covering Beatles tunes pretty early on.
The Beatles are way popular down there, and it makes sense to me because the level of songwriting is so strong down there still, with real interesting harmonic schemes. We've had this talk about mm-hmm. how perhaps, you know, blues and rock and roll have stripped away a lot of the harmonic complexity of American music, which is ultimately has devolved, in my view, don't shoot me, into rap with no harmony mm-hmm. and no melody. But that hasn't happened for a large segment of the Brazilian musical population. It's still cool to write tunes like Jobim with these wonderful harmonic plans, or even, you know, more complex than that. You know, it's really wonderful to stumble onto.
And Jobim's music is like their standards, right? I mean, everybody.
Yeah, he's like their Beatles, I guess.
Yeah,
he's the overwhelming. Well, for musicians at least, I don't know if you ask the average 20-year-old, you know, how many Jobim tunes he could sing. I don't know. I do know I've been to, it's wonderful going to concerts down there with people who are boomers or, you know, even slightly older, and you'll hear a guitarist play a Jobim tune, they'll all break into the lyrics. It's really...
Yeah, you hear that on live records by Brazilian performers. They're just, the crowd is singing all those songs
right
along with them.
Yeah, and they all know, 500 sambas. It's astounding. I mean, I'll never be able to know as many sambas as somebody who grew up there would know.
I don't think you're supposed to.
No.
We're going to hear, going out, a piece from your latest record with the clarinet player Evan Christopher, which is a Nazaré piece as well?
As well. I just have fixated on Nazaré because he's accessible as, you know, solo piano music. The big hero for the choro players down there is a fellow named Alfredo Viana, whose nickname is Pixinguinha, and he was a fantastic instrumentalist and composer. Anyway, I just fixate on Nazaré because I tend to go back to the whatever music form I study, I go back to the very earliest guys. And
you're a roots guy. So what's the name of this?
This is Garoto, which means, whereas Garota de Ipanema is girl from the Ipanema, this is the dude, Garoto. Garoto.
Tom McDermott and Evan Christopher. Thank you. thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your new love of Brazilian music with us.
Well, from one fanatic to another, I thank you as well.
And when's your next time in Brazil? When you're going down next?
Certainly in August, and I'm hoping in February.
Cool. I envy you.
Well, you got to come with me.
Okay. So long, everybody.
My thanks to John, Mark, and Drew at Piety Street Recording Studios in New Orleans, and to Tom McDermott. That's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via shortwave, WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, now nationwide on Sirius satellite radio, and on your computer around the world whenever you want it at two locations, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com. And it'll be just like having digital TV for Christmas if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail@interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and is distributed through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Happy holidays, everybody.